Made in Latin America.
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 Made in Latin America. Latin America.
Welcome to Made in Latin America, a podcast brought to you by the Santo Domingo Center of Excellence for Latin American Research at the British Museum. Join Santo Domingo Center curators Laura Osorio Sanax and Magda Arauz Sieber on a road trip from the east to west coast of the United States and along the border with Mexico. In this season, you will listen to their various experiences visiting these places and conversing with leaders of fascinating cultural heritage projects that support and advocate for Hispanic, Latinx, and indigenous communities from a wide range of fields.
Hola a todos. In this episode, we're going to drive from El Paso across the border to Mexico. This is very exciting because neither of us had done this before. But prior to visiting an archaeological site in Paquimé and a feminist organization in Ciudad Juárez, we started our trip at El Paso History Museum.
We ended up in El Paso in the first place. We knew we wanted to go to El Paso, but the whole point was to go from Terlingua to cross the border at Presidio and then cross over into Mexico and then drive around Mexico to Ciudad Juárez and then cross the border at Ciudad Juárez to arrive in El Paso. But we got to the border at Presidio and tried and failed. The young man on the phone in Houston who had told me that the car was eligible for, like, to take the car over the border was wrong. Through that particular car rental company, the only permission that you can get is for commercial transport. And so there was just no way of redoing our contract or anything, and that obviously the Mexican border was just not going to let us over with an uninsured car. So we spent quite a while trying to figure that out, and then we drove from the border right back up to past Marfa to El Paso and to try to find a way to then cross the border, because I think we were told that at El Paso you could cross the border, but we needed to rent a different car. And then the city itself is quite lively and hip and fun and full of, brilliant people.
You remember that when we were driving down the city, we could see this massive urban space that looked at one big city. But then we realized that it was Ciudad Juárez on the left and El Paso on the right.
That's right, because we were driving at night. It was just getting dark, yeah. And so it just looked, as we were coming around the hill, it looked like El Paso was this enormous city, right? Which it is, because it's El Paso and Juárez together. But obviously, yeah, trying to take it back to the people that we were when we got to El Paso, we'd never been to Juárez, right? And everybody that we met kept saying, we met someone who worked in border enforcement, chatted to a couple of taxi drivers, chatted to a couple of PhD students who were studying physics, and all these people were just like, oh yeah, Juárez, yeah, like, I'm from Juárez, yeah. Or I go there all the time, it's the same city, etc. So it felt like this whole border was a construction. And we knew that there would be, obviously, the bureaucracy of crossing the border and then having to sort out the car. But, like, we didn't think that there was going to be a huge divide between the two cities, in spite of what we knew about the border. We were advised that we couldn't get across the border in El Paso because there was too much traffic. And so the best thing to do was to take the next border crossing over, which was just outside the city. So in fact, we crossed the border outside of El Paso and came straight out into the middle of nowhere countryside in Mexico. And then drove down this awful dirt road to get to Paquimé, the archaeological site, Casas Grandes. Again, that's a very strange town, which is divided into two. It's old Casas Grandes and new new Casas Grandes. Casas Grandes is the old-fashioned term for this archaeological site, which is there. And it's one of the few famous archaeological sites that's kind of endorsed by the INAH, which is Mexico's National Heritage and Anthropology Organization. But the indigenous word is Paquime. So most people in Mexico know this place as Casas Grandes. In any case, the archaeological site is stuck to old Casas Grandes, which is an old colonial town. It's really small, with a couple of churches and town squares and like nice old Spanish colonial buildings. Pretty sleepy, nothing to do. And then it's stuck, that's stuck on the other side to Nuevo Casas Grandes, which is built around one road. It's built around the road that arrives from the border to old Casas Grandes. Where old Casas Grandes like is like any colonial town, right? It's built around a church.
We go to the Museum de Culturas del Norte, no? The North Cultures Museum that is next to the Paquime site. And we were trying to find someone to speak with about the site and to see what kind of research we're doing now and if they could tell us more on these dynamics of different communities inhabiting that space or encounters between different groups of people around Paquime.
Unlike the other archaeological sites in Mexico, Maya sites and Mexica sites, etc., which are huge monumental stone buildings, Paquime is at its highest 20 meters off ground level. Approximately. And we drove up to the museum and sort of in desperate need of someone who would help us. And like, luckily, and this is why you got to love Mexico, the field archaeologist was sitting around in his office and agreed to meet us.
Carlos Gutierrez Sanchez.
He gave us a tour of the site. It was inhabited from the 12th century to the 15th century. That's just to give you an idea of the time scale. If anyone has seen Pueblo-style architecture, it's comparable. We're talking about mud sort of walls with soft edges. It's kind of a honeycomb style structure. So one room leads into another, and there are sort of outer complexes and inner complexes. But the way that the site is designed is that it's divided into different house complexes is the way that I would describe it, i.e. like a community, possibly a family, live in one area. So you have to imagine those bigger houses as kind of cluster communities, right? And every single cluster is shaped like an animal from, if you see it from bird's eye view, it's quite beautiful. And every now and again, you're in a position to look down, let's say, onto the structure of the walls inside of the living space, and it feels quite game-like.
And it's interesting to see how these dwellings had storerooms, courtyards, meeting rooms, bedrooms, and they can identify the uses by finding certain materials there. So you can imagine, maybe this is more, it's something normal to you as an archaeologist, but for us it's interesting to see how can you imagine a whole living and social dynamic by just observing certain materials and the shape of the building. And you can construct and imagine what was happening there and the people, how people interacting.
We were chatting to Carlos, and he was, because what we were interested in knowing, right, is like how contemporary communities engage with this site, right? And there are lots of really interesting narratives about, you know, indigenous sovereignty or indigenous, let's say, brokerage with archaeological sites, about how they're used, etc., in Latin America. And he was saying that there were lots of people who effectively had lived with the site as children, and this was Mexicans who now lived in the United States or Mexicans who live in different parts of the country, had lived with the site as somewhere that you could just walk around and play with the labyrinth and like jump up and down and hide and play hide and seek and etc. And that's what people were doing until the ENAW, which is the Heritage Institute, gets involved and is like, well, no, I think you'll find that we'll be preserving these walls and you have to pay an entrance or whatever. I mean, I'm not trying to, not in any way trying to make out that this is sort of macabre activity and Mexicans get in free to heritage sites on Sundays and things like that. So it's fine. But it was just obviously the informality of their experience was completely destroyed by the making of this as a heritage site, which is interesting. And then the other thing that he said, which I quite liked, was that there were people who, and when the site was first excavated, there were actually people who lived in the site.
That was 100 years ago around, yeah.
Yeah, they were like they were living in the site and using the walls as part of the protection of their houses. And so when they were ejected, they were sort of transplanted to this set of houses next to the archaeological site. And they and their families all still live there. So there's a kind of... There isn't, or at least according to the archaeologist, there isn't a strong... let's say, indigenous interest in the site, I think partly because the people who inhabited the site abandoned it and were and are connected to lots of itinerant communities. But what there is a different kind of indigenous community attached to the site, which is the people who had made it their home.
Oye, oye, pronto vas a doblar a la derecha, ¿eh?
Yeah, me avisa. Bueno, igual me lo va a decir.
So then after we stayed, after we went to see Pakimir, we drove off in the middle of the morning and I remember driving and not being able to see anything. We arrived at Ciudad Juárez. Ciudad Juárez is quite dangerous. I can't remember exactly what happened, but there was a terrorist attack of sorts inside an Oxxo. And Oxxo is a common Mexican like convenience store. Yeah, it sells eggs and beer and cigarettes. And basically, people were killed. And so the idea was that we didn't want to really be so much in Ciudad Juárez. So we decided for safety's sake to try to drive to Ciudad Juárez very early in the morning, get there for around sunrise, meet these women that we wanted to meet, which is the Red Mesa Mujeres, which we can talk about in a minute, and then cross the border without really having to stop anywhere. So Red Mesa Mujeres was something, again, that I found on Facebook. I'm always interested in grassroots feminist activism in places in Mexico that suffer the effects of institutional corruption and drug trafficking, because of course it's a major issue, right? There's like there has historically been a lot of femicide in the region in Ciudad Juárez, and that had to some extent been not resolved, but the statistics were diminishing. But there are still young women who are raped and murdered and dumped outside the city or dumped in the city all the time, right? And then there is never any resolution to find the culprits. Obviously, it's a hard task to do the things that it takes to make the social changes needed for that to stop happening. So the people who really are at the front line of trying to seek repair and justice for those crimes are the mothers of those young women, right? And so Red Mesa de Mujeres is exactly that. And they were going to march from a supermarket on the outskirts of the city to a faraway point, actually on the US-Mexico border on the motorway.
And this group of women, they have been fighting for social justice because their daughters were killed more than a decade ago. They've been...
Some of them were
so more than a decade trying to find some kind of justice and trying to reopen the investigations that have been closed. What I thought it was really interesting from their perspective is how they're using urban artistic interventions as a way of making visible this violence against women and showing that the city itself, it's also an expression of that. An apparent progress of capitalism and a justice system that has actually perpetuated that violence. So at some point, she was mentioning this intervention next to the rail tracks, remember? So we have a train as a symbol of this industrial or economic development that we know that in different forms has abused women. And at the same time, we're talking about a place where women bodies are being found, not only in Ciudad Juarez, but in other cities. She was saying that they're being killed in downtown, but their bodies are thrown there. So it is a very loaded and emotionally charged space to reflect, first of all, what has happened in society, and also, why are those voices being silenced? And why are those women still being ignored? Bueno, gracias, Yadira. ¿Nos estabas contando? Here, Yadira is explaining that there are emblematic points around the city. And she says that it's very important to visualize and reconsider the urban narratives. And she's explaining that there is a cross of nails, she tells us about, that was made in Chihuahua and brought here to Ciudad Juárez and received and put on the Juárez Bridge, which is one of the emblematic points of the city. It's one of the places where women are disappearing. She mentioned the case of Jasmine, who has been waiting for years, but she also mentioned successful cases. For example, there was a trial in 2015 where five men were sentenced to 697 years of prison, and that was a great step forward for them. And the case has been taken as an example for many others in Chihuahua and Ciudad Juárez. Yadira mentioned another emblematic point in the city, which is the cotton field, in which Red Mesa de Mujeres has made an intervention as well, putting an emblematic text and plaques as a memorial. That text was taken to the Inter-American Court, and it has become quite significant. That intervention was in the beginning being maintained by the citizens, by the community, but it has become so important that now the government takes care of it. And when talking about these artistic interventions and emblematic points in the city, Yadira says that it has a lot of meaning for the families. It is a way of making visible the violence against women around the city and make the point that prevention is the most important thing. That's the most important goal for Red Mesa de Mujeres, is for the government to take prevention actions. So Yadira says, if we prevent, there's nothing to regret later. That's why they recently put crosses in the government's offices, specifically in the general attorney's office, as a symbol of demand, but also as a reminder of the voice saying, my daughter went through this, and you need to work really hard to make justice and to prevent for this to keep happening in the future. Yadira also tells us about many murals with the victim faces that the mothers have been creating throughout the years. For example, the case of Susie. Two of her daughters were murdered in Ciudad Juárez. And in the cemetery, they created a piece of work with mosaics, reconstructing their lives. She explained that there's a lot of pain involved and love while creating this intervention, so they're treated with a lot of care as well. The particular event we attended, it was to inaugurate the memorial in the North Creek of Ciudad Juárez, where they created a sculpture that they call Beating of Resilient Heart, and the idea was to explain all the elements involved in the sculpture and the meaning behind it.
Mi nombre es Olivia Murillo.
We also had the chance to speak with Olivia Murillo, one of the mothers that is part of Red Mesa de Mujeres. She was saying how important with these public events is to be recognized as a movement and also to raise the voice to try to stop violence against women. She was saying that there are already too many women that have been killed. And for her as a mother, it is very important for the cases to be properly investigated with a complete protocol to put in place so they can not only find the truth, but stop impunity.
Muchas gracias.
Yeah. No, it was a really emotionally overwhelming experience to talk to them, I think, because in a sense, I think Magda and I, we were both asking ourselves the question of why we were getting involved. You know, it's like, to some extent, going to talk to them in Ciudad Juárez felt, it felt somehow disrespectful because we're not actually part of any political or developmental or NGO movement, right? And we're not part of an activist project. So somehow, so we worked for a museum, and there's a relationship because they do interventions and installations, and there's a relationship because we're a museum that have artifacts from the region, because museums are connected to colonial networks, which are connected to some of the power asymmetries and injustices that people in contemporary Mexico continue to face. There are all these kind of, somewhat distant reasonings for being interested in that project, but fundamentally, it just didn't feel very easy to explain to these women what we were doing. And at the same time, I felt like it was really important to highlight projects like that in this region, because I suppose they are, the most powerful resistance projects. They are not intellectual projects set up in universities to, let's say, create some visibility or for some justice for marginalized communities. They're not related to mainstream representation through museums. They don't have powerful dissemination channels, right? But they are, they're definitely tackling some of the most difficult social realities in the region, and they're doing it for a local community. And if there's any project that deserves some platforming or would benefit from platforming, I thought a project like that would do. I suppose where it gets tricky is that, of course, we can platform the project on a podcast, or we can platform the project through the British Museum, but fundamentally it's the wrong audience to some extent. So I was unsure about the positive benefits of doing it, and at the same time felt compelled to do so.
So we visited El Paso, not only because it's a border city, but also because we were very interested in El Paso History Museum and one of the projects they have, which is called DigiWall. El Paso History Museum has gone under a massive renovation because originally it was based on El Paso history, but from a very political perspective. So it was... The exhibition was basically a list of mayors throughout the years and their actions. What happened is that they hired Erika Marin. Erika Marin is the first El Paso native and Latina to be appointed as the director of El Paso History Museum. And she realized that this museum wasn't telling the history of the city, wasn't considering people living in the city. So she organized this major shift to turn El Paso History Museum into a community museum and change the permanent exhibition and starting to do different projects to engage different communities in the city with the collection. One of them is called DigiWall, and it's a digital platform that exists on a website but also is projected at the entrance of the museum. It has thousands of videos, photos, pictures, illustrations that are part of the history of the city and that people can engage with by commenting, adding information, even uploading photos, personal photos or things that they have that are related to their histories, their personal experiences in the city. So she's turning this museum into an open museum that is platforming families, communities, histories, and different social dynamics, and showcasing them. This is Stephanie Gardea, the museum registrar and the administrator of Digi.
So with this archive, Digi is community curated, essentially, and that is something that is so fascinating because I always tell visitors, you know, even though you're not from here like yourselves, you know, you can still get a full kind of firsthand understanding of what is El Paso's history and culture like. As I mentioned earlier, you know, you can see everything from Pancho Villa to archives at Special Collections, archives here, but you can also see people's graduation. You can see their alumni ceremonies from their high schools. There's a lot of community pride here, and I think Digi helps reflect that especially. My favorite is having visitors come, or I bring family and friends in, and I'm like, oh yeah, look at this wall, and they just happen to be searching it, and they're like, oh my God, like, that's my grandmother, and they have no idea how they end up on there. And I'm like, okay, well, let's see who uploaded. Oh, do you know this? Yeah, that's my sister. And so it's this very kind of special experience of like stewardship and, you know, people really taking ownership of the museum. You know, they quite literally see themselves reflected in that way where they have their own family history up on the wall. And so it's really nice. And, you know, you have those instances of like the family histories, the very localized histories, but we also use it to our advantage to, you know, create an archive and a historic repository for not just ourselves, but for communities and historians to use.
We talked with Erica Marin about her perspectives on building a community museum.
Previous to my employment or my time here, there was this idea that whatever was worked with community was actually brought by a committee of historians, whether they were academic or lay historians, and that's the community that was worked with in order to create exhibitions. But from my personal perspective, and I think now as an institution, from our team's perspective, that is still kind of a top-down approach to doing the museum work, especially when it comes to exhibitions. So we kind of decided that maybe that's not the direction we want to go. We want to be a little more democratic in how we select and how we vet exhibitions and how we work with them. So we go out into the community, put out our feelers. For example, one of the first ones was the Lowrider exhibition that we had here a year and a half ago. And that Lowrider exhibition was a huge success. And the reason it was a success is because we reached out to the Lowrider community. We asked permission. We did not assume that they wanted this to happen. We asked their permission to put the show on. And when we got their buy-in, we obviously asked them to participate. And so everything, that exhibition would not have happened without them. And sure, there was a lot of writing and a lot of research, both academic and otherwise, that went into the project. But more than anything, we validated stories. We became friends with the community, and we have those relationships that are now solid. We're still in communication with that particular group of people, and who are our group of people, because we are from here, so they're like our uncles or our cousins, and so it makes it a little easier for us. But more importantly is the way we look at doing, at creating exhibitions and programming isn't from a top-down approach, but it's from a more democratic approach where we reach out to the community and gauge their interest and gauge their desire to participate, because if not, then there's no point. Mm-hmm. This museum is for them. So we hope that we honor that.
One of the things I just wanted to say that I don't know if you do it on purpose, I imagine that you do, but I think what's really inspiring about the way you speak about your practice, both of you, is the verbal use of museum. To museum, we want to museum differently.
Yes.
And so museum is not this one solid static noun. It's now a verb, and you're changing the meaning of what that verb means on them constantly.
Correct, because we remove it from this monolith. If we can reshape and take it away from being this monolith, and we discuss more of it as an action, then we can reimagine what that looks like, so that we can hopefully, in this space, reimagine those methodologies in ways that are more inclusive and democratic and reverberate more with community. I just feel that our long-term vision really is to continue to do this work, to do work that engages, to not part of this re-envisioning of how we do work, even internally, is how long do we work? How do we take breaks? If we've worked several, just a crazy amount of hours one week, how do we step back the following week? Because that's important. That's really important to replenish and to take care of ourselves, right? It also looks at how we share the process. I'm not too fond of, personally, myself, is one thing that I always found very stifling is everybody in their little silo. Mm-hmm. A curator does only this. Educational outreach person does only this. A registrar does only this. We don't do that. This process is highly collaborative. Sometimes it's difficult. It's not easy, and it doesn't come, but this is another way of re-envisioning what that practice looks like, is saying everybody has creative input, because everybody here is valid. There's not a curator in their ivory tower, and that person sets the tone for everything. It's we all set the tone together. We make decisions together. Even the smallest decisions we make together. We have multiple perspectives and multiple experiences. And yet, within all those multiple perspectives and multiple experiences, we all come down to one thing, that we, each and every sector, knows its community very well and knows this community very well. Regardless if, I had in, when we wrote the intro panel for Lowrider exhibition, one thing that we put is it's not subculture, because the lowrider culture is not sub to anything. It's part and parcel of the community. So removing those ideas, so subcategories, that's very European, that's very Western, to always sub things, always, well, this is on top and this is on bottom and this is, start removing that from your mind and think differently about how, and when you start removing that from your mind, then you start understanding that everything's connected. And that is why we connect with a community, even though there's so many different experiences and lifestyles and everything, is because at the end, we all understand each other.
That's beautiful what you say, yeah, because I think there's a tendency, isn't there, for a lot of people to say, no one really knows things anymore. No one knows anything about history anymore. No, no one cares about the community. And what you're saying is the opposite.
Of course we do. Yeah. We know our own history. Even in our families, we know history.
Yeah.
All of their archival material is intervened by members of the local community. So people can say whatever they want on an open website about who's in this photo, what's going on in the photo, what it means. For example, this is an example. And I asked her the really conservative, lame question of, so who's going around checking that all the grammar is correct? Because that's like what we do with our website, right? Like, make sure that all the sentences are properly...
Grammar is your worry. I thought you were thinking about
post-truth or false information.
No, I completely and utterly got that in the first one. I think that's perfect. I think there should be no empirical truth about what this archival material means, right? She's clearly forefronting community perspectives rather than specialist perspectives. She's putting forward the idea of positionality, right? That there are lots of different positions about what all this archival stuff means. There are thousands of voices involved. And as long as they're local community voices who care about the material, then the museum has no place being an arbiter of what's right and what's wrong. But so I get that. But I was a little bit concerned about grammar. But not just grammar, also, what's the word? People do use digital interfaces all the time as like to unload like bad language and like trollish ideas, right? That's the thing. So obviously there is a person who curates it to some extent.
I think she wasn't correcting even the years or something. If there was misinformation, she wasn't correcting that, but just taking care that nobody is attacking someone else or there's no misuse of a platform in that sense.
And she doesn't make any changes to like orthography or syntax or anything like that. And the idea is that it's not policed in that erudite way, which I think is great, actually.
Yeah. And I think it's this turn of the museum. It affects the way people understand how you leave the city, because then they understand that they're part of the city, they're part of the system, and they're contributing in different ways to build the history of the city. And it's not just a mayor. It's not the people in charge politically of the city, but the city is built by communities and what the communities, those communities... The city is built by people and by what those people do around the city. So I think that's a social impact that the museum, El Paso History Museum, is having.
It made me reflect a little bit, I don't know if it did this with you, Magda, too, on the way that we manage our digital products or digital, what do you want to call it, platforms related to the centre, which, you know, obviously is we don't manage them in any way in the same way, right? We don't have pictures of, let's say, items from the America collection at the British Museum with places where that you can write whatever you want to say about what this object means for the public. And I'm not suggesting that we do, but it is interesting to consider that one of the major and most convincing critiques, I think, from local community perspectives of museums, history and ethnographic museums, I'm talking completely aside from, you know, claims for restitution, social justice goals, etc. Literally just why people don't like museums like that and don't go to them. It's like this old pot, like what does this old pot have to do with me? And it's so obvious why in the case of the El Paso History Museum, why all that archival material is relevant to the local community and why they would want to say something about it and get involved and write some narratives and etc. But it left me with the question of how you could make historical collections like the collections that the British Museum has relevant to local communities beyond the idea of information, beyond the idea of interest, just because it's in a different culture, etc. And also beyond, let's say, co-stewardship or post-stewardship with communities of origin. So I mean literally people who hang around in London, not going to the museum or not.
Yeah. That's it for today's episode. And on the next episode, we'll be driving through the desert plains of Arizona, straight to Tucson and Phoenix. And we'll chat with some interesting people who work in the field of architecture, museums, and art.
Thanks for joining us in this episode of Made in Latin America by the Santo Domingo Center of Excellence for Latin American Research at the British Museum. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to share, like, and rank the podcast on your favorite platform. To learn more about our projects, visit our website, sdcellarbritishmuseum.org, or follow us on Instagram at sdcellar.bm. This podcast is made possible by the generosity of Alejandro and Charlotte Santo Domingo and Mrs. Julio Mario Santo Domingo with Andres and Lauren Santo Domingo. Made in Latin America was engineered and edited by Pronk Productions. For more information, visit pronkproductions.com.